Okay, you asked me to give an overview of V4-4 signaling, and so I'm going to do that with very quickly summarizing what we already know about this object, and then talking about the 2015 outburst, and there have been more than a dozen papers already. I'm not going to try and cover all of them. I'm going to select one, some that I was involved in and others that I thought were particularly interesting. Right. It was discovered in 1989, and it was the second brightest ever seen in X-rays. Of course, at the time, and the reason it attracted a lot of interest immediately was that this is what we thought of as a classical transient, fast rise, exponential decay. We were starting to say, we only had four or five examples, that this was the this is the way they were, and
they should be.
And the way they okay, thank you, Jean-Pierre. And we had these two. We didn't have very many because you don't know when they're going to go off. And from the first 20 or 30 years of X-ray astronomy, we didn't have all-sky monitors. But in the late 80s, the Ginga satellite was launched, and it had an all-sky monitor. And it started picking them up, of which the first one was G2000. And it fitted in beautifully into this. And then, well, less than a year later, this one went off. And this is GS2023 plus 338. And you can see its X-ray light curve. This is about 3 weeks of time in here. And just remind you, this is a logarithmic plot. So there's three orders of magnitude here. And Tanaka, in the very first paper, said this thing had the most incredible variability they had ever seen from any X-ray source. Sometimes, factors of 200 in an hour. But overall, the decay timescale wasn't that different from some of these other ones. Okay, the other curious thing is, and it's true to this day, it's still the only X-ray transient that, when it was optically identified, it was already in the catalogue of variable stars. V4-4 Cygni had another name, Nova Cygni 1938. So it had been, not surprisingly, misidentified based on the very limited. So in our very first paper, this is the very first paper on V4-4. And we were able to present the light curve from 1938, as well as the one from 1989. Curiously, this one lasted 2 months, whereas the decay in 1989 was somewhat faster. There was another outburst around 1956. But of course, that was before X-ray astronomy. But this is the great thing about having plate archives that you can go and rummage around in. It was once seen bright on just one plate in 1979, but there was that was slightly puzzling. Okay, 1989. Here is that X-ray light curve again. Here at the bottom. This time, this is radio, optical, and X-ray plotted in log intensity and log time here. So this allows you to compare the radio, optical, and X-ray behavior. And the steep decay in the initial radio outburst was interpreted as a synchrotron bubble event here. So, and the optical spectrum, this is the first one that we obtained, just a classic X-ray irradiated disk with the normal lines that you would expect, helium-2, Balmer, helium-1, and the Bowen blend, which we made a lot of use of later. All right, that's just the key things from the 89 outburst. But the great thing about this one, it's proximity to us. And because it was found to have a detectable faint radio source, even in quiescence, James Miller Jones was able to use VLBI to do something we're not used to in X-ray astronomy, which is actually seeing, here is the parallax, the motion of the source in the VLBI, from which they got this parallax, 0.4 milliarc seconds. And so its distance is 2.39 kiloparsecs with an error of 0.14. We are just not used to that. We're used to say, oh, it's 3 kiloparsecs, we think. It might be 6. You sort of add these kinds of arguments. You can't do that anymore. We have, this is the first black hole X-ray binary with a very precise distance, which means, of course, we knew its luminosity. Oh, the, James put it, just a lovely visual. Here is us, that little red dot there, and the big red star, that is V44 Cygni. You also get out of the VLBI, and this is the peculiar velocity in the galactic plane, and it's consistent with a Blau kick in the supernova event. And because of the distance precision, we now know that 20 crab peak, which Ginga saw, corresponds to a luminosity of 8, 10 to 38 Ergs per second over the complete energy range, or about half Eddington for a 12 solar mass black hole, slightly higher if it's maybe 9 or 10, and I'll say something about that in a moment. It also meant we now know precisely what the quiescent luminosity is, 7, 10 to 32, and for those of you who remember this paper that Ramesh Narayan and Jeff McClintock did, comparing the quiescent luminosities of the neutron star systems, the open circles, with the black hole ones here, there was one object which appeared to be up almost in neutron star territory, that was V404 Cygni. But in fact, this red arrow shows it's not here, but it's actually there. So that makes, if you believe this relationship, then that makes that fit in there. Anyway, we have precise luminosities, something that which is great. Because of that proximity, when it's in quiescence, it's actually relatively bright. And that's because it's one of the two long period LMXB black hole systems. The other one is, of course, 1915. And the period here is 6 days, which means you have an evolved donor. So it's actually brighter than most of the, all of the short period systems. And so that meant that in quiescence, we could get the radial velocity curve of the donor. And just to remind you, for the non-observers here, that the thing we measure, of course, in the donor is just the period and the K2 velocity, the mass function. And if you turn this equation around, put it in this form, then you can see it's particularly useful, because defining Q here as the ratio of the black hole to the donor, this is a large number. So 1 over Q, we can immediately say, is 0. And if you put the inclination here at 90 degrees, the mass function is the mass of the compact object. And of course, it's got to be less than 90, which I'll discuss in a moment, which means the mass of the compact object exceeds this, which is why getting this in the transits has been so important. The other thing, by the way, just to remind you all, these things must all be co-rotating. And hence, the rotational speed of the donor, which you can't always measure, as you'll see, is simply matching this. And and of course, we know what the radius of the donor is if it's filling its Roche low. We've got that. And so these two equations give you this one well-known expression, in which if you can measure the rotational velocity here, then and you measure the K2, of course, you get Q. Anyway, all right, we did that for V404, and this is what why it became such an important object 25 years ago, and that is that mass function was 6.1 with a tiny error, and our spectra were more than good enough to easily, here's our template, you can see how we measured the rotational speed of 40 kilometers per second. You put it into that equation there, Q is 17. So you've instantly got, you know its mass is greater than that. And that's why this was such an important object. In the last 25 years, Jorge and I, and quite a number of others, particularly Jeff McClintock, we've got what I think is 21 realistic masses. And this is from Jorge's latest review, which has just come out. And so these are the neutron stars down here, and this is the plot of the population. And you can see already there's a gap in here. That is suspicious, but there's all kinds of selection effects finding things in here. Do we have two different types up here? Anyway, there's lots of interesting stuff to do, but we'd like not to have 20, we'd like to have 100 in here. And so that's why these objects are so important, because it's only in the LMXB systems that you can get this kind of accuracy with the masses. All right, I just have to say something briefly about the quiescent light curve, because you may say, well, I got the mass function, I got Q, I don't know the inclination. Well, it has the well-known ellipsoidal light curve, and this is several years worth of data plotted for V404. The trouble is the scatter there, that's not measurement errors. The measurement errors are the size of the symbols. So there's a lot of variability and flickering and flaring going on in the residual disk. And our way around this was to say that the lower envelope of this defined the ellipsoidal variation of the donor, and we used that, modeled that to get the inclination. And we came out with a number of about 56 degrees doing this, depending on what degree of contamination you have. This number is very, very precisely known. And of course, we know it's not eclipsing. So it can't be above 70. And this is the range that we went for, which is what got the original 12. Move on about a decade, and near-infrared spectroscopy of it with Keck. I have to say, the data quality is really good. And their template suggested it was a K3 giant. We got a K2 subgiant for it. Very, very similar. These are very subtle differences. But they got a much smaller disk contribution of less than 3%, which I have to say, I don't understand. And you can see that here on this plot is their spectrum and the template star. You don't need to have any disk contamination in there to get a really good fit, which is why they've set an upper limit of 3%. So that pushes the inclination higher, and hence the mass comes down slightly. So they preferred 9. But I would suggest that it's, you think of it, it has to be something between 9 and 12 in there. When I, Gonzalez Hernandez and Jorge got this, analyzed the spectrum at much higher resolution in the optical, and they got back to a K2 spectral type. So you can see the subtle differences, but they also saw significantly enhanced oxygen abundance, which they took as being the donor being contaminated in the supernova explosion. They suggested it might have been a hypernova there. Otherwise, the rest of the abundances are fairly close to normal. So that was the result of the atmosphere modeling. But you do have to remember, and I keep telling people, this is not a normal star that got there to that, you know, what we see is the K2, K3 by normal stellar evolution, because remember, it once had a very, very massive star next to it and a lot of mass transfer going on. We also know very precisely the separation in the binary, 31 solar radii, and we know its radius, and we can use the Eggleton relation. We can actually calculate log g fairly precisely, and we don't get the same number that you get from the stellar atmosphere. And there is no one has a simple explanation for that at the moment. So what the mass is comes down to constraining the inclination, and Jorge and my student Christina Zurita, in her thesis, put together the ellipsoidal light curve over a decade, and you can see, there are systematic trends in there, and so this is what leads some people to say. Argue over what the disk contamination is, as to whether it's around. So that I would say the inclination's got to be something between 56 and 67. It certainly can't be outside that range. All right. Lena Pavlenko in the Crimea Observatory monitored V404 over many years. This is the 5 years, 6 years following the outburst. And you can see this is just the light curve on the mean, folded on the 6.5 day period. And you can see that there's a gradual trend downwards as you move in the years away from the outburst. So clearly was fading out away. Maybe the disk contamination getting a little lower. But we also knew from these plates, and in fact, it went off in 1938, went off again in 1956, maybe it did 79, we're not sure, found in 89. We thought it's going to come back on again. Just to finish, Elena's data, that variability that you saw on the when folded on the orbital period, if you just look at what it is, it's got flickering and flaring, it has a time scale of about 6 hours or so. Something's going on in there. This is the light curve, what the light curve looks like after you subtract out the ellipsoidal modulation. So clearly there's disk and ongoing accretion at a very low level in there. Right. This now, starting in 2009, Dave Russell and Fraser Lewis and their postdoc, Federico Bernardini, have been using the Forks and Las Cumbres telescopes. Appropriate to be talking about this here in Santa Barbara, close to Las Cumbres. So this is, they're monitoring about 40 LMXBs optically. And this what you've got here, this is a 6 years light curve of V404. And in three colors here, V, R, and I. And that is the 2015 outburst. Up and down in 10 days. Much faster. So it certainly caught us all virtually unawares in there. But if we look at that a bit more closely, this is that same data set. You can see that the trend down stopped about 5 or 6 years ago, and then started increasing. And of course, you got Jean-Pierre here, and we had Jean-Marie here. I don't know if you discussed any aspects of this with the disk instability model, but the increase, this gradual increase, you can see it perhaps more clearly here in the R band, started 2 or 3 years ago. But the other thing you can see, you see this dashed line? The dashed line is the date that the GCN and the telegrams all came out, because the X-rays just turned on with a bang. But those two red points there, as I've blown up this section in this plot, these two points are from 1 week prior to the outburst. And so the optical rise actually began clearly about a week before the X-ray. So
also the fast decay.
You'll see that in a bit more detail. Yes, it was. It turned off very, very quickly. So, in quiescence, we have a disk out somewhere out here which has to move in. For the X-rays to be detectable. And so this is in spite of what you might have thought, that if the disk was out here, that we had it's an outside-in event. It's not. It's inside-out, because it begins in here, and this the extra viscosity causes the disk to move inwards. And this is what takes about a week to get from here to here. And we've never seen that before. But, and this is the really fun bit here, that not only did we have photometry from before the outburst, as Christian was saying, these things go off and you never have data taken before or during the rise. Actually, we did here, because somebody was observing V404 on the WHT 13 hours before the outburst. And that was me. And that, here I was 25 years later on the same telescope with the same instrument looking at the same object. Why was I doing that? It's because Jorge and I realized that our radial velocity curve, which has been the ephemeris that everyone's used for the last 20 years, had about a point one phase error projected forward, and we thought let's nail down the radial velocity curve, just get a couple of points here. And so at the end, this wasn't the main target, that we were doing J1753.5, in fact, for completely different reasons, and we did this at the end of the night. So it was the last thing we did. I just noticed, gosh, oh, the H alpha is easily visible this time, and I knew that close to the H alpha were these absorption lines from the donut. And that's all I wanted there. But because it was the last thing at the end of the night, I just saw, oh, that's good signal to noise, H alpha is there, we'll look at that and get a velocity out when I get home. And so we closed up, I got on the plane, and less than 12 hours later, I turned on my laptop and looked at the telegrams and said, bloody hell, this was just extraordinary. And so we had, this is the spectrum that we got here, and I've blown up the H beta and H alpha regions here, This is the H-alpha blown up even more, and you can see that compared to our normal quiescent spectra, H-alpha was 7 times stronger. But more importantly, the width had increased from below 1,500 kilometers per second up to 2,500. And you can use the this formula to calculate the inner disk radius at which this is formed. And it means that it's moved from in quiescence out at about 17,000 Schwarzschild radii into about 6,000. And that's the motion that we were actually seeing and expecting in the dim to move from the truncated disk. And this is Jean-Pierre is on this paper, and so this is that was our explanation there. Right. So that was that's where the bang started, and this is perhaps the nicest overview in Sarah Motta's paper that's only just been submitted. Here, this is the integral light curve, and this is the SWIFT data. This is the entire outburst. It actually ended. It's not detectable after this point. This is 10 days here. This is a log-log plot. This intensity is in crabs here. That's 100 crabs up there. Similarly, 100 crabs here, okay? So it may have been shorter, but it was 3 to 4 times the peak luminosity of the 1989 event. And again, you have to plot it in log-log, in log space, because the range of variability is staggering in here. Now, Tanaka, in the very first X-ray paper, said, not only is it highly variable, we are seeing staggering changes in the spectrum, which they interpreted as, they said, it looks like large column changes. And at 2.4 kiloparsecs, we know the extinction quite accurately. We know what the interstellar column is in there. Now, in the SWIFT observations, some of the first images, this is the real SWIFT X-ray image here. And there's a lovely paper by Andy Beardmore, which has, they called V404 Lord of the Rings. And these are the images, and you can see the rings moving with time, because all the X-rays here are being scattered off dust layers around 1.5 to 2 kiloparsecs from us. So within 500 parsecs of V404, you've got these dust sheets, which are being illuminated by the flash. And you're seeing that in the scattered X-rays here. I thought that was, when they first saw it, they thought something was wrong with the instrument. Just give you an idea about that X-ray variability, in Sarah's paper, she's fitted all of the integral and SWIFT spectra here with a cutoff power law, a partially covered power law, in which the interstellar column is fixed. In other words, we know what's going on between us at V404. And so these are all fit with exactly the same model. So this shows you the kind of spectral variations that are happening in here. It's basically in the hard state, except for just very few spectra in here where it looks like somewhat softer, but very rare. It's mostly power law around 1.5. The most interesting point here are the column. Remember, the interstellar column is taken out. And that's the interstellar column, the dotted line there. That has already been, that's already added in. You need two other components, a low column, which are basically have a clear view, and a high column, which is around 5, 10 to 8 times 10 to the 23, maybe over 10 to the 24 at times. So in other words, we've got highly variable clumps of stuff which are getting in front of the primary X-ray source.
Remind me, it never makes a full transition to a soft state, you're saying?
Correct.
In the hard state throughout the...
I don't think you can call it hard state.
You can't really.
It has a hard spectrum, but it's not a hard state.
Oh, it's really a very high state.
Then. Right, it's really,
it's a very
okay. Okay.
You mean that all the sort of X-rays are absorbed by all the
stuff? Not necessarily, it's just very... it's a very hot disk, I guess, but...
It's not a classic Q diagram.
But all this stuff would absorb all the soft X-rays as well, right? So you wouldn't see the soft X-ray.
That's so right.
It can't reach you.
At these columns, right. you can't actually say anything about.
Right. Everything that actually is able to reach you must be hard.
Well, keep in mind that some of the columns are quite low, and the fluxes during those times are still pretty high. But I do agree with that.
For instance, in here, that you just see the lower column, but the focal index stays the same.
Yeah.
Can you do a sort of absorption correcting X-ray color? I mean, or is that even feasible?
Once you get to like 24,
you're totally systematic.
In fact, yeah,
right. Let me go on. There was that was obviously broadband spectroscopy. There were some Chandra DDTs done, and this is from the King et al. Paper. You can see a broad iron, but with the narrow iron components, and within their spectra, these are the silicon, sulfur, and iron lines, with time going from bottom to top up here. So you could see the variability just within these. And at certain times, you can actually even see an X-ray disk wind being excited. You probably can't read this, but these are the iron lines up here, which you can see clear P Cygni profiles, certainly absorption components, which are and these are at about 1/10 of the peak luminosities that we're seeing. Even harder X-rays, this is Dominic Wharton's paper, which it's on AstroPH, but it hasn't appeared yet. Their observation picked up a number of flares. This is their mean spectrum from 3 up to 80 here. You see this very broad iron line and the hump. The spectra of the flares are shown over here on the right, and this is just an example of one of their models. They had to have four components to get a fit to their spectra, and you have the blue is the disk, the orange is the high energy parallel tail. This is the disk reflection component in magenta, but they had to have another more distant reflection component, and they admit in their paper they haven't a clue where it is, but they need it in order to fit the spectra.
These are not reflections, clearly. There's no reflection component at all.
I know.
The spectrum what Watson shows has nothing to do with reflection.
Yeah.
It's transmission through this cloud.
Yeah. But this is how they parameterized that. And presenting, as I said, there's a huge amount of gorgeous data, and there's still a lot to come out, a lot to be done with this.
Did any of Sarah Mata's bits require a disk component, or no?
She parameterized it as just the parallel, and so that was not.
I think he tried it though.
Yes.
He
Okay, here's the first, well, here's the complete light curve again in the integral. And obviously we were observing at other wavelengths. These colored bands, these are observations that Poshak Gandhi led using Ultracam on the WHT. Again, with all these things, the great advantage of using a big telescope is you can go to phenomenal time resolution. And the of the four observations we had with Ultracam, one we had no integral data at all from that block. This one was right in this minimum when it just dropped away and wasn't doing anything. This one here was even weaker, but our shortest observation, which is these data here, coincided with this beautiful flare in here. And these, this is the AME radio observations. There had been a flare there as well. So there's the Ultracam, and here it is at the Ultracam resolution in two blocks. This block has a time resolution. This is at Ultracam's maximum speed then of 24 milliseconds. And even there, some of these, that is indeed a single pixel, a single bin. It went up and down within 24 milliseconds. Interestingly, because Ultracam, remember, gives you blue, green, and red simultaneously, the blue variations are much slower. This incredible fast flaring is totally happening in the red. This is a blow up of just one part of it to show you how exquisite these data are. Why did that go back? Oh, that's because, unfortunately, the movie, it's fun to, if I can show it to you on my laptop, but I got a little movie of the a minute of the of this, and it is fabulous. Anyway, the power spectra, you can see for that, these are the power spectra for that night. These are the others, which were nothing like as interesting. And you can see that the you've got much more of that power at the high speed flaring in the red compared to the blue. Now, here's a fun bit, all right. When I looked at that light curve in Ultracam, it made, I remembered this. Does anybody know what this is? Anyone recognize? Not many observers here, so. It's an X-ray source. So this is actually an X-ray light curve, not an optical one. But the time scale of variation is almost exactly the same. Do you remember it? No, it would have been, it was before your time as well, so. Okay, this is GX339 observed with HEO-1 back in 1979. And this variability and the fast flickering was, I thought, looked exactly the same. Anyway, I throw that out. Of course, Integral also has its own optical monitor. But it can't do very fast. It's only a 5-centimeter aperture. But it can do minutes. And in the Rodriguez et al. Paper, they found that the optical, which is the green part in this cross-correlation down here, this is the cross-correlation, this is the actual data, the optical seems to lag the X-rays by a few minutes, and that shows up in the power spectra here. And we've been thinking about what is happening there, and I am wondering if you are not seeing the X-rays heating up material which has gone further away from V44. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Right. So this is from Teo Muñoz Darius's paper, the overview, in which we got WHT spectra again. We got Grantican spectra. Why have a 4 meter when you can have a 10 meter? And of course, it's incredibly bright, but it means, once again, you can do extremely fast exposures and get high time resolution. So this is, once again, the complete light curve in integral, the thing disappearing after 10 days, radio and optical. The whole thing is in logarithmic plots here. Right, and from those Grantican spectra, over the whole of the outburst, they were, the spectra are at the times marked by the colored vertical bars at the top up here. This is where, in the helium 15876 profile, we saw this beautiful Picigni profile. It was present on every day, larger on two of them. And there's one where we had X-ray, optical, and radio simultaneously, and you could see there was a X-ray and optical flare in here. And this is a plot. This is the profile now shown. This is the velocity up here. And so you've got time going from left to right, showing you how the Picigni profile is basic. This is the absorption component of the on the blue side being launched. This material is being launched at the time of this flare. And to be in helium 1 means the temperature can't exceed, a few tens of thousands Kelvin. And so you've got to be out at least 10 to the 4 gravitational radii to launch this wind in here.
Sorry, Bill, what's the extreme red side? Why is it turned on? What is that?
That's also the...
It's the retro.
Do you really think that's what that is?
Yeah.
Doesn't make much sense. No, why not? I mean, you've got the room component in your line of sight being launched, but of course there's also stuff that's going away out of your line of sight. Yeah.
So you see a
well.
So this may be the right thing, but it's nowhere near as obvious as that, because what you see in the wind is scattering. Right, so this would be scattered red light, but the dominant, by far, almost always, emission light, emission mechanism for these things is recombination. And so you're really saying here that you're saying, so it's easy for absorption superposed and emission to show up, but for the scattered emission to show up, you're saying that the recombination, that the scatter component of that must be competitive with the recombination light. That's pretty damn rare.
We may come back to that. Just to complete, right towards the end of the outburst, it seemed to brighten in gamma rays, and Fermi picked it up right before the source died. So here's the Fermi image, and the...
It was quiet before then, and then boom.
Here is their data from that whole period.
Sorry.
That's the lat, and is green, and where this is their light curve down here. They could have detected it throughout the entire outburst. They only detected it right at the very end, at this point, when it reached its highest level in the integral BAT here. Then they saw it. So this, of course, is 0.1 to 100 GeV. This is substantially lower energies, but there was clearly something happened.
So which wave bands have the very sharp drop? It doesn't look like all of them do, but just like that one does clearly.
All right, this is this is the optical at the top.
Does, yeah.
And so you could see this is down at quiescent level between 17 and 18, and it's peaking at above 11th.
And then the next one, 50 kV also.
This is now hard X-rays, somewhat harder X-rays, and this is now true gamma rays. Down here. This is the schematic that Sarah put together for that paper on all the integral and Swift spectra to try, in which you've got what, I did think this is, this section, maybe Marek and Jean-Pierre can come up with a better description, but this is the, what's usually called a slim disk, whereas this is the thin disk.
You just got some slim disk, you missed it.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Okay. And so these the heavy clumps, and you saw the outflow maybe in the Chandra P Cygni profiles, getting these heavy clumps, which is what gives the large periods of very high column density. Whereas the wind that we saw, and I was just showing you, has to come from out of this region, out here.
Yeah, this is not very super Eddington, right? So.
Well, it's just super Eddington.
So you don't expect slim disk or this time, it might be really super Eddington.
Okay.
But I mean, how do we know that it is not super Eddington, yeah, by factor of 10? Because what we see a tiny fraction which is transmitted through the wind, because you see only the hard X-rays. Where are all the soft X-rays gone? They might be in the UV.
You can have Sean Fagos. You have an expert of very, very luminous flows.
Indeed.
And just Eddington, you wouldn't have this.
You are not that thick. Yeah. Why it seems to vary in that rate, like in terms of scale height. But I'm not sure whether this, like what the poor means to scale or not.
Certainly not this stuff.
This is cartoon, right? Let's be clear.
Yeah.
This is nothing. This is
cartoon. No, but the wind should start below. It could be a wind, but
right.
No, but Phil said that we are observing it at 60 degrees. So I mean, if it's super Eddington, what you see, it's a tiny fraction. The rest goes along the channel, not along the funnel in the middle.
The viewing angle's got to be fairly close to being right. Even if the rest of the schematic would not be physically.
Yeah, so here's the slim disk, as it's called here, is now known as a torus.
Okay.
Right? But isn't it much more logical that it is a super Eddington
configuration? Clumpy wind. That's what it is.
I mean, one thing I was going to say earlier, so I think is we had a long discussion with Sarah about this, and it's in the paper now. Always makes me suspicious, not just of what you're saying, is the columns that Phil mentioned, like the high columns, whenever they infer, they always come out to be of order 10 to the 24.
Yeah.
Makes me deeply uncomfortable when you get that, because it's basically what you're saying is it's marginally compensated.
Right.
And I just think, to my mind, it always smacks of a massive cosmic conspiracy that if something happens to just give you this great optical depth of order unity. What the hell? I mean, if this has nothing to do with, either it's a complete conspiracy that I don't buy, or actually it's radiation driven in some ways, and that gives you naturally an optical depth, or you actually have no idea what the optical depth is, and it's maybe 10,000, and you're just, I always wonder whether to what extent once you get up to 10 to the 24, 10 to the 25, to what extent you really should be thinking of those things as lower limits, essentially.
Yeah, can I come to Phil probably wants to continue.
This is actually almost at the end. That was.
I strongly encourage people to go to the massive stars discussion. I mean, we still have time because Stan has been working on
Is Stan talking? Is that him today?
Italian and Stan, yeah. And Stan has been working on, you know, conformation in Eddington and Super Eddington Alpha. I mean, I think they've been thinking about these issues for a very, very long time, and maybe they can provide some insight, even though this may all be systematic. I mean,
One related comment to the modeling, because all this NH comes from the model that is obviously by definition wrong.
Right, and it because, must be wrong.
People use, like, for example, you have a bunch of reflection models, that's why people use them. There's not a single transmission model in XPEC. Right. Yeah. People have developed it for CIFAR 2s, but they are not in XPEC. People are not using this. And if you look at this Watson paper, it's transmission spectrum, iron age in the transmission.
Right. I agree with you completely. In fact, I thought that's what Christian was going to go towards, because I think once you reach that sort of level, that the modeling of absorption is completely artificial, and it's almost certainly something totally different.
So yeah, just to be clear, Sarah is very clear also in the paper that, you know, this is just, once you think of it as a parameterization.
It's a parameterization, yeah.
But I think it's important, particularly important, to remember that NH in particular, even as a parameter, you have a sort of natural limit. I mean, has anybody ever seen a model of anything that gave you an NH of 10 to the 27? Right? You can't, that's the point, right? Once you have 10 to the 25, you're done.
Then you basically get an X-ray photosphere.
Yeah. Right? You probably get nothing, yeah.
That always gets you this distance
right.
And forth, because
right.
It just moves with
right.
The world.
Exactly, so people, I think, when you see these sort of hard upper edges there, you know, it probably means something physically, but not what you might think. You didn't just say, "Oh wow, look at this! It's all nice, saturating at this number." I don't think that's what that means.
Yeah,
so Phil, what really surprises me about this thing is that it is over in 10 days.
Yes.
Because the previous outburst lasted for much, much longer.
Actually, they did one other thing, which I didn't include it. Because it's a minor point, but it did another mini flare right around the end of December, just around Christmas of 2015, and it was only about a week, and we got more GTC spectra, which I have to say, for you non-observers, observing Cygnus at the end of December is nigh on. It was below 30 degrees, what's still in twilight, but we got spectra, and we got exactly the same P-sig profile for the helium-1.
Well, you need four where we screwed me over. I had DVT HST observations for both of those, for the main one and,
right.
And in October and in December, and it was over before we got onto it both times.
Yeah.
Faster.
Yeah, that was, so it was, anyway, I... you can see why. Sorry, Jean-Pierre.
I have two questions. One is, you say it's the first time optical outburst, but 16, you have cited already at 97, which was an explanation of the observation of optical before.
Yes, but not with spectrum.
In 1640.
1655. Right. Yes, but not with spectroscopy.
Not as good as that, but it was the first.
Sorry. What I meant was that that we actually had spectroscopy, which we didn't. It was just photometry.
But the model that was used for
this
that was designed to explain the
delay
in
1655. Right.
I just want to comment that this rise in optical before the outburst is exactly what the disk instability model predicts. The decline after outburst, this depends, it's not, but
that's the problem, isn't it?
It depends on the detail, but the rise in optical is just in the nature of the model. It is, the disk is filling up, you can see it in the movies that were shown here, so it's exactly
what you
the light
of well, the
papers,
it
goes like that.
Well, worse than that, I think the other thing I think we also shouldn't forget this, that, right, everything you've seen there, this is a completely bizarro outburst, right? Like in every way, this doesn't look anything like the previous ones, even from the same source. It didn't do a Q diagram. The variability is way more extreme than you've seen in virtually any other source, as far as we know, I think. So I think we have to be a little careful in saying, oh, it's just, you know, a well-observed dim outburst is probably known.
But then I don't understand what outburst mechanism is unknown. the last slide when you're. You mean the. The outburst is unknown?
The outburst.
I mean, the mechanism of the general outburst? What do you mean, unknown? I mean, it does what the disk is. What do it more than the agreement with the prediction of the disk is not the model?
Indeed, for the way it began, I was thinking more of why that this is producing such extraordinary X-ray light curves compared to all the others, which have much, much more uniform light curves. That's what I was.
Thank you so much, Bill. People are voting with their feet right now.
Yes,
thank you.